Hello, we're on the air. This is Kathy Cook with Bright Lights Pathfinders, also known as Bright Lights Pathfinders. We are going to be bridging wisdom tonight with Paul Dale Roberts. He goes by Paranormal Investigations. He is an investigator with over 400 investigations under his belt. His articles lead him to many documentaries. He's on the History Channel and Conversations with Serial Killers. There's so much to tell about Paul. I don't like to do too much of an intro. I like to bring them on the air. So I'm just going to bring you on the air. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Kathy. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I would like for you to, you are headlined on BBS. So if anyone wants to contact you or gain information, it is located on the headline page for tonight and next week, actually. Paul, I just met you, and you're just one of the most passionate guys I've ever met. I called you the mystery man when I first met you.
Yes, I did.
I don't know. You are just so mysterious with so many different ways, but your charisma and your empathic abilities and your passion is just amazing. You've got such a feel for you. I don't prepare for my shows. I just, it takes the flavor out of the concoction. I just go with the energy field and let it flow because that's why I don't like to do introductions. I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. My name is Paul Dale Roberts, and the reason why I go by all three names is because my dad's name is Paul Marceau Roberts. So when we were both working for the state, he was getting my personal phone calls, and he says, okay, you got to go by all three names. So anyway, I'm a paranormal investigator with HPI, Haunted Paranormal Investigations International, and we cover all of Northern California, but we go other places like Jamaica, Aruba, and every place else. We hunt not only ghosts and poltergeists and demons, but we also too hunt UFOs, and we do monsters, and we even do conspiracy. So we do a little bit of everything.
Wow, Paul, I know that you're tell us a little bit about your military career.
Okay. In 1973 and 1976, I went in as an MP, a military policeman. So instead of directing traffic, they had a major drug problem over in Germany, and they had a thing called the Khaki Mafia, and this it actually originated in Vietnam, and it went over into Germany, and the German people were actually working with GIs in distributing narcotics throughout Germany. So they needed people that were streetwise, so I interviewed for the position. And the glory of the job was I got to wear civilian clothes, my undercover persona was that the fact that I was a soldier who got out of the army and was a drug dealer. So I traveled throughout Germany on government money, stayed in nice hotels, hung out at discotheques, and bought drugs and testified at Article 32s and court-martials.
Oh, my gosh.
So I did that till 1976. And I was working with the Criminal Investigation Division Drug Suppression Team. So I did that for, 74 to 76 in Germany. And then I went back into the service in 1979 from watching a James Bond movie. Believe it or not, I'm not kidding. But here I am. I'm sitting in a movie theater and I'm watching James Bond. And all of a sudden I start thinking, I said, what is it that these military intelligence guys did? I mean, you know, I would see these guys in their suits and everything else. So before I knew it, I was talking to an Army recruiter, and I said, what is it that military intelligence, what is it that they do? And he built it up in such a way that it seemed like James Bond. So before I knew it, I was signing the dotted line, and I became a 97 Bravo intelligence analyst with the Photo Interpretation Center in Korea.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had a top-secret SBI clearance, which stands for Special Background Investigation. And we studied aerial reconnaissance photographs of North Korea and China. And while I was there, and you got to excuse me, I'm in California, so my sinuses are killing me. But,
okay. That's great, because I just got over pneumonia, and I was broadcasting with hardly any voice. That's quite all right.
Wow.
You're human. Or are you? Mystery man.
Yes. I'm definitely human.
Okay.
A human with a nose problem. anyway, so while I was there, you know, with military intelligence and everything else, it was that's where I saw six UFO photographs that actually came in. And on the back of these photographs, they had intelligent movement. And there were a variety of UFOs from cigar shape to disc shape to one that looked like ball lightning. And these were taken by our satellite reconnaissance photographs. So they were part of a bigger picture, which they had video footage, which I didn't see. But those six photographs came in, and at that point in time with military intelligence, I knew that we were not alone. So that was just totally amazing, you know, for me to see that. So,
with you being an empath, how did you feel when you saw that?
Well, the only thing is, Kathy, I'm not an empath. I'm not a sensitive empath, psychic, or anything.
Oh, okay.
You have the most enlightening
feel to when, you know, we talked on the phone. The empathic ability to me is an intense feeling, you know, that people get like when you move into somewhere, when you're in a crowded room or whatever. But if you're not an empath, that's okay. Then you're sympathetic.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny as people, they do think that I have psychic abilities or I'm empathic, but I don't know. I just don't really see it, you know, so.
Let's rephrase the sentence, the question. With that circumstance that surrounded you, how did you feel? Give me some descriptive adjectives of feelings that you felt when you saw that particular the photographs and the UFOs.
Well, I knew at that time that the government was actually hiding something, that they knew a bigger picture. They're seeing a bigger picture than we are seeing as civilians. So it was, for me, it was astonishing. For me, I knew at that point of time that we were not alone, and I felt very comfortable with that. I said, okay, everything I've ever read about UFOs and everything else, and we were talking about ancient aliens to the Sumerian clay tablets, must have happened. So that in itself was just fantastic. But anyway, while I was in military intelligence, before I knew it, they gave me an H identifier, which meant I was an Army instructor. And I had to wear a ski mask, a Soviet uniform, and I had a fake Russian accent. I called myself Corporal Dabrowski.
Do the accent as you tell the story.
You know, so I can't even do it anymore like I used to. So
yeah,
it's like
that's all right.
I kind of lost it. Yeah. But I actually taught the Soviet threat, and when I took off and revealed myself, took off the ski mask, I would say something like, my name is Sergeant Paul Dale Roberts, and the Soviet soldier is and must be considered a formidable foe. We must attempt to understand why and what makes him a good soldier. Is it his attitude, his background, his culture, or his weapons? Let's look at the AK-47.
Wow, those are great.
Anyway, but yeah, I had a very interesting military career, so I really loved it. I had some good times, a lot of good times, a few bad times, but the Army was good to me.
Well, you know, there's so much to ask. I want to hit on your dancing career because I want to just share with you when I was 12, went to study. Go ahead. Just talk about your, I'll tell you what later. Just
well,
tell
you. You know how I got into my dancing career? This is real weird. When I was doing the NARC thing from 73 to 76, I had to hang out at discotheques, so I would watch people dance. And before I knew it, I became very proficient in dancing. So in 1976, when I got out of the Army and came to Sacramento, California, the very first job that I landed was with Arthur Murray's as a dance instructor. So I did that for a while. I joined Jeff Kutosh's dancing machine, and we were the first number to share when she went solo in 1979. And I was the third and fifth disco king of Sacramento, and I danced. Now, here's the shocker. I danced 8.5 days, 205 hours, disco dancing for the Guinness Book of World Records, and I was featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not.
No, amazing. That is amazing. So you kind of tranced out there, I guess, to keep going.
Yeah, so yeah, my path in life, it just took me to one direction, to another direction.
It's very colorful, I'm telling you. The comic book career. Let's hear that one.
That was during the time when I was married. I was married for 10 years, and I was walking with my ex-wife, and we were walking past a comic book store, and I told my ex-wife, I said, you know, I used to read comic books. And she goes, really? She goes, well, let's walk in and take a look. And I go, yeah, but I don't want to get hooked on comic books again. And she goes, well, let's just look at them. I said, okay, let's look at them. So anyway, she went and bought me the Death of Superman series. And before I knew it, I read it, and I got hooked on comic books again. So one day I was just telling her, I said, you know, one of my fantasies is to actually publish a comic book. Well, she looked at me and she goes, Paul, you're a very good writer. And she goes, why don't you do it? And I said, well, I would need an artist. So on my birthday, she had me meet her at a restaurant. So I met her at a restaurant and she's sitting there with this guy. I said, wow, what kind of birthday is this? Okay. You know, she's sitting there with a guy, you know, and wow, you know, I'm a real loser here. You know, so I go over to the table. I go, yeah, you know, who's this guy? I mean, they're like really into a conversation there too. Yeah. And she goes, Paul, she goes, remember your fantasy is to publish a comic book? And I go, yeah. She goes, write that comic book because this is your artist. This is Brandon McKinney. Brandon McKinney was a very, very popular comic book artist that did Star Wars.
Oh, wow. I said,
holy crap. She paid for him.
That's great.
Yeah. So anyway, I wrote the script for the comic book. It's called The Legendary Dark Silhouette. And he did the artwork, and I published it.
Amazing.
And now here's the funny thing.
Let me ask you before you go anywhere. When you were, was it already written in your head, or did you go with what you wanted to produce with this with the artist?
Yeah, it was already in my head.
Okay.
So all I did was put it on paper.
Uh-huh.
And this independent movie producer by the name of Howard Nash, for the last 4 years, he's actually bought the rights to the Legendary Dark Silhouette and said claims he's going to make a movie out of it. Every single year, he pays for the rights of the comic book and still has not made a movie out of it.
Amazing. Timing. Yeah.
If he ever makes a movie out of it, I swear I will fall off my chair.
Well, you know what? Let's just put it out there and bring it to you. Listen, Paul, what is Jamaica? Because I know you love Jamaica. You're going to tell us a good story from Jamaica. Is Jamaica the comic book publishing company, right?
Oh, no, yeah, Jasmine Comics, yeah.
Jasmine, okay.
Yeah, Jasmine Comics, and that's published the Legendary Dark Silhouette.
Let me tell you why I called it Jamica, because my children's initials are J-A-M, and I'm M-A for Ma, and I have a Kathy, C-A-T-H-Y, so I call it Jamica. I just wanted to tell you that.
Oh, that's pretty cool, Kathy, I like that. I like the way you interject with cute little stories. I love it.
Do you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you're going to, and when I tell you my Jamaica story, I know you're going to intervene and tell me about this story about something about your mother being the queen of Jamaica.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
She and Dad went there every year for he was a 33rd degree Mason, and I don't know the story behind he quit that, but while he was involved in that, they went to Jamaica. And my mother, she was, for 10 years or so, she was queen of Jamaica. She was crown queen. They did the whole ritual thing because she always won the goat race and a bunch of other little things. And that's how she became queen.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of little doodads from Jamaica. I've got dried bat to little, she'd bring me back voodoo dolls and didn't even know that's what they were. You know, but it's just cool, you know. And then, you're going to tell the story because it's one of your major investigations that you had. Where, right?
Right. Well, Jamaica was very, very unique. Okay, I did the White Witch of Jamaica. The White Witch, back in the 1800s, she would have slaves out there working on her sugar plants, picking the sugar canes and stuff like that. Well, anyway, she supposedly, here's what the legend says, but she killed five husbands. One, I don't know what she did to him, but he jumped out of a window. Another one, she poisoned. Another one, she had a slave kill him. I forget how she killed the other two. But she was a black widow. And she's called the White Witch of Jamaica. And she's also too called the Witch of the East. And the White Witch of the East and the White Witch of the West is actually Errol Flynn's wife, which still lives.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Errol Flynn's wife. And the reason why they call her the White Witch of the West is because she's very bad about paying her servants. So, but the White Witch of the East, who lived in the 1800s, she would have sexual affairs with her slaves. And if she was intimate with you and you were a slave, you had about a week to live.
Oh, my gosh. That's why she's a black widow.
Oh, yeah. She was a...
I am confused. What's the difference in a white witch and a black witch?
Well, with her, she was a petite French woman. So when they say white witch...
You're talking about her looks. Okay.
Yeah, her skin color, yeah.
Okay, because to me, a white witch is, you know, really good with, you know, harm you none and lives by the Wiccan reed, to where the black witch is like casting spells, voodoo, and all that stuff. But now we got that covered.
I'm gonna go back to Jamaica and tell them. We'll say, look, you're confusing a lot of people. Call her the Caucasian witch of the West.
Yeah. But you tell them that that she fools them with her cloaking and disguise. Oh, but yeah, that's really strange that there's one on the east and one on the west. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about this. You said you had a juicy story of Jamaica.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, when I got to Jamaica, it was so funny because I would have these Jamaican people come up to me. They go, hey, you want some ganja, man? And I go, ganja? What the heck is ganja? And they go, ganja, man. You know ganja. You know Bob Marley.
Reefer.
I go, Bob Marley. I mean, you're talking about the Jamaican artist. They go, no, man. They say, I'm talking about Bob Marley. You smoke a Bob Marley. I go, what? A cigarette? What is that? They go, marijuana. And I go, oh, marijuana. I said, I don't smoke ganja. You don't smoke ganja. What you doing in Jamaica, man? I go, oh, my God.
Isn't that funny?
Believe it or not, I'm here to relax and to investigate the White Witch and everything else. So anyway, but one of my people, like on Facebook, was from Jamaica. And I told him I'm coming down to investigate the White Witch, blah, blah, blah. He says, oh, my God. He goes, you're going to write an article about this? I say, yeah, I'm going to write an article. He says, you got to come on my boat. I'm going to take you to Haiti. I go, what? You're going to take me to Haiti? He goes, yes, I want you to interview the Voodoo Queen. So I said, okay, why not?
How far was it? How far? Far of a ride?
Like, that's almost like a 7-hour ride.
Wow.
So anyway, it's like here I am on his boat, and he's got a couple men on there and everything else. So we get
over there. Trusting. You sure are a trusting man.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, I talked to him on Facebook, and I know he's really into my paranormal stories. So he was basically a really good fan of mine.
Okay.
So I did trust him, and the boat ride was kind of cool, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when we get over there, two guys are waiting for us, and that we have a Jeep. And then they said that they have to blindfold me when we get closer to the place.
Oh, nice.
The Voodoo Queen can't disclose where she lives at in Haiti. So I said, okay. So they blindfolded me. They took me to this little place, and it looked like a shack inside when they unblindfolded me. And here's this very, very beautiful Voodoo Queen girl. I mean, she looked like she was very young, but they claim that she actually predicted the Haitian earthquake before it happened. So they really have a lot of respect for her, and she had this big bodyguard standing next to her. And I was a little bit nervous at the time.
When was this? I mean, the date.
Oh, I have to look back at my article, but I know it was in the beginning of the year, so maybe.
Okay, that's all I needed to know, that this was recent. Okay.
Yeah, it's probably like in February when I went on vacation. So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we're in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, I stopped off in North Carolina. Yeah. That was my layover.
That's where I am.
Yeah. Dang, if I knew you then, I would have stopped by. And,
I know, right?
You
know,
we could have had a cheeseburger together or something.
Cheeseburger.
Cheeseburger and a milkshake.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was a little bit nervous, blah, 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 interviewing her. And they kind of cut the interview short. But what she was trying to tell me is that she prophesized that the United States during this year that we're going to have monetary type problems. And that the stock market is going to do a major crash and everything else. And food items are going to skyrocket. Gas prices are going to skyrocket and everything else. So it was sort of a gloom and doom type prophecy for the United States. And then they cut the interview short, and then I was blindfolded and taken back to the boat. Now, here's the scary part. Well, anyway, we crossed over the line because I can't even talk.
Where we were at.
Okay, yeah. It was a coastal little town. But anyway, we crossed over into the Dominican Republic, and another boat met us, and that's when I realized he was a gun runner. They were actually loading up guns on the boat. I go, holy crap. So I was really, really panicking at that time, and I was really nervous, and I was very stressed.
There's the trust thing. That's where I was pulling that from.
Yeah,
because I kept feeling that trust thing going on.
So, yeah, he was a gun runner and everything else, and I'm seeing these AK-47s and everything else coming on the boat and everything else. So it was like, holy crap. So anyway, I guess I was really, really stressed out. So when I left Jamaica and came back home, I had a problem. And it's something that happens to a lot of cops and happens to a lot of firefighters. And it's something I really told nobody on the radio. You're the very first one I'm going to tell this to. But anyway, I started noticing that I started getting some hair loss on my eyebrow.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I said, what the hell is happening?
Of all things, your eyebrow, that's where your personality shows, you know?
So anyway, it started really concerning me, and one of the people at my work, she noticed it, and she says, Paul, she goes, what's going on here? I go, I don't know. I said, it happened after Jamaica. She goes, you need to go to the doctor and find out what's going on. And so I went to the doctor. Yeah, I went to the doctor, and they called it something. It's one of them long names, and I can't pronounce it. So anyway, and they said it's caused from high stress. And they
See, there's your trust, man. Woo, good. That would.
Yeah, so they asked.
That's your eyebrow from stress.
So
my God, that was heavy.
Yes,
blindfolded yes. Guns, white witch, golly, the doom and gloom of the United States, goodness gracious.
Oh, I know. And so anyway, they said, well, is it because of your job? And I go, no, I'm not stressed out at my job. I love my job. And they said, well, when did this happen? I said, right after I went to Jamaica. They said, how can you be stressed out in Jamaica when you're laying out on the beach drinking pina coladas? And I said, I did a little bit more than that. And I kind of gave them a rundown of what I did. And they said, because of the high stress that causes that. So they had to give me a couple shots in my eyebrow. And my eyebrows are back to normal again. But they had to give me a couple shots in my eyebrows. And
I'm checking your eyebrows out the next fit. That's why you wear those sunglasses.
No, that's not the reason. But
I'm just kidding.
Anyway,
but
it's like, okay, it's like, wow. And I said, does this happen to a lot of people? And they said, usually people with high stress jobs, and they said, we see a lot of cops, we see a lot of firemen that have this problem, and it's because due to the stress. And I go, wow. And
gosh, you were a firefighter for a year, and that wasn't your cup of tea.
No, that wasn't my cup of tea because I was out there. It was a big fire in the Sierras, and I was stationed in Colfax, and I was working with the California Division of Forestry. And when I went out there to fight this fire, they were yelling. They said, Robert, spot fire. Well, spot fire is a small fire, so I'm trying to put out this the spot fire. I turn around, and there's flames like 20 feet high. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, my God. And my captain's yelling at me. He says, Roberts, get into I can't say the bad words, but get into the bleep, bleep roots of the fire. And I'm trying to get in there, and I could hear my hair singe. I could smell my hair.
Oh, wow.
I could feel the heat on my skin. And I said, I can't do this. This is crazy. I'm going to get burned. So I threw down the hose. The hose went crazy. You know, if you throw down a water hose, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you know how it just moves around like a snake. Well, you can imagine with a big hose like that, that thing was just flying all over the place. And the captain's like astonished. He's looking at me and going, what the heck? And I'm sitting on the fire truck. I got my arms crossed. And he's
like, I quit.
Oh. Yeah. He goes, Roberts, get down from that fire truck and get in the roots of the fire. And I gave him the bird. And I said, F you, I quit.
Wow.
That was the end of my firefighting career.
Well, that's a good, at least you went out with a 20-foot flame.
Yeah, but I totally respect firefighters. I mean, they are.
My son's a firefighter.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's right. I think.
He's one of four that can drive the water tank trucks in this area. You know, the East Coast area, and he does the Jaws of Life. He trains others to become firefighters.
Kathy, one thing is your son and every firefighter out there are heroes. I mean, risk their lives, and that is a very, very dangerous
You have
job.
No idea how I had to let go of that. My grandfather and grandmother's house burned up with them in it, but they got out at the nick of time. My grandfather's building burned. I've been around fire. My aunt got caught on fire. There's so many treacherous stories about fire in our family, and then my son goes and fights them. But he started drawing woo-woo trucks and woo-wooing at age two. So it was his destiny to be who he is today. With the, you know, he's just now changed from one station to another. So that was a very heavy. He did a walkout because he didn't agree with some things that were going on in the county, and he led the walkout. He's very headstrong, but now he's training. And when he was in a fire, like pretty much like yours, his helmet burned because the beam fell on his head, and he was protecting his captain. And he was in the hospital a while. And, you know, it's been scary. But he is now, you know, when he was, we had to get him a new helmet. And he wanted one from New York, but they don't pass the code. He had to get one from Texas. So that was what I gave him as a gift for what he went through.
When my firefighting captain, I went back there about 5 years later just to see some of my old buddies over there. And my firefighter captain, who was cussing me out and everything else when I quit, he looks like a young Robert Redford.
Yeah.
And when I saw him, he had a burn mark on his cheek.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's
scary.
Yeah, that's
I burnt my leg for third degree burns on a mini bike, and my brother sat on it while it had been running like 5 hours, and it flipped over, and the exhaust stuck to my leg, and I can tell you, then I dated a guy that was 90% burned on his body that was third-degree burns. It's not pretty. And my son tells me some stories where they rescued people, dogs, animals, you know, and it's amazing what you went through. So to be able to say I don't want to do this anymore because it's not my cup of tea, that's a very strong person. And I just want to say you were all put in things for a reason, you know. But that'd be a good story for you to write because you have a writing career that is off the charts here, I understand. Like Sacramento Press and Haunted Times Magazine. You go ahead.
Oh, well, it's funny that you mention that because I actually did write a story about my firefighting career and how firefighters are heroes, and that was published in a Smithsonian magazine.
Whoa.
Yeah, so yeah, I actually did that. And what really cracks me up about the firefighters over there, though, they listen to the radio all the time. They're waiting for the next fire. And
tell me about it. My son lived here for 5 years with that thing going on. I know he had it. He has it tuned into his ear constantly.
Oh, yeah. And then they'll raise up their T-shirt, and I said, well, you see this scar right here? I got this back in 1982 the Colfax fire, you know. And they talk about their different scars, and they know the year and the fire and everything else and all the details. And, yeah, it cracks me up. And I didn't have any scars to show them.
You know, when I got married, my sister got married. I backed into the candle, and my hair caught fire. My brother had to put it out. But, gosh, I tell you, fires are probably the most dangerous. Well, I'm just astonished at your writing career. That's the part that's just amazing, because I love to write, but I trance out when I write and just get messages, and I have no clue what I'm writing until I study it. But you have like Newsweek, Time, National Geographic, People Magazine, Writer's Digest, comics.
You know, here's the funny thing about that, Kathy. When I was married, my ex-wife, when we went to Hawaii for our honeymoon, she took me to a psychic. And at that time, I didn't believe in psychics. I mean, I do now because I got psychics on the team, and they floored me with their predictions. Or what they were seeing in the home or whatever. Uh-huh. But she took me to a psychic in Hawaii, and I said, well, you know, save your money, you know. And she goes, no, because this psychic, she can see your past, you know, and all this other stuff. And I go, oh, whatever, it's your money. So anyway, I went to see this psychic and everything, and she looks at me in the eyes, and she goes, Paul, she goes, you have a very old soul. I go, well, okay, cool. And she goes, I see you. And she didn't know me. She didn't know that I was a writer or anything like that. But she looks at me, and she goes, I see you in Rome, back in the Roman times, and you were a very, very popular scribe, and there was a lot of people following you around. I go, wow, that's kind of interesting, because she didn't know I was a writer. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought about that and said, well, maybe I am an old soul, you know. So, but you know, here's the crazy thing about my writing. When I was about 8 years old, I was reading Brad Steiger's books on the paranormal, because I thought I lived in a haunted house. So I started reading everything I could on the paranormal, and I started getting into UFOs and ghosts and monsters and everything else. And at the age of 8, I start writing all the time, and my mom said, what are you writing? And she grabbed the paper, she looks at it, and she goes, who taught you how to write a diary? And I looked at her and I go, what's a diary? I didn't even know what I was writing, but I was every day I was recording things that I was doing.
Isn't that so nice?
Yeah, and then at the age of 12, my very first thing I ever had published was a letter to the editor in the Monterey Herald. And then I was hooked. I saw my name in print, and I said, okay, this is it. I'm hooked.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah, and I've been writing ever since.
What's your favorite piece you've ever written? But everybody's pulling me to pull you back to UFOs. I can feel them. They're like all about this UFO.
Oh,
but first, I want to hear your favorite piece you've written.
Oh, very favorite piece. Oh, my gosh.
Which that one right there?
You know, it's probably right now is my HPI book. It's called HPI Chronicles Ghosts, UFOs, Monsters, and High Strangeness.
So, what is a monster?
Oh, like, you know, Bigfoot and Chupacabra. I've actually hunted the Chupacabra and Bigfoot and everything else. So, and I've done a lot of UFO. We just did Area 51.
Did you really?
Yeah. We just went to Area 51.
How was that? What was that like?
Well, we got over there and we interviewed a few people, and they said they hear a lot of sonic booms. This one lady actually claims that she saw some kind of strange craft with an American pilot in it, and was hovering at the height that she stands. That's where it was hovering at, real close to her, not making any kind of sound, and the pilot just merely waved at her. So I said, wow, are you kidding me? And she goes, no, I'm serious. She goes, but it was an American pilot. It wasn't a UFO or anything else, but it was a military craft that I never saw before. And she was out in the desert when that happened. So I said, wow. So there's a lot of things going on in Area 51. When we went up to the gates, I mean, they got tons of video cameras. They got all kinds of sound enhancers. They can hear you walking. They can hear you talking. And there was a Jeep that was actually pacing us, and you could see his dust trail. He was pacing us as we approached the gate. And then off in the hill was this guy in camis, and he was looking at me with binoculars. I was looking at him with binoculars, and he's looking at me with binoculars, and right on his back strapped was a sniper rifle.
Oh, my gosh.
So they don't play around.
They don't play around. Neither do the Jamaicans.
Yeah. And, oh, the alien. Okay, oh, my God. That's, you know, really popular. That was in the movie called Paul. And you could actually see the alien. But the people there are so nice. And they actually let us camp out at their property. And then the people that actually frequent the bar and everything, they took us to 3 haunted locations. So not only were we hunting UFOs, but we actually did 3 small investigations in 2 trailers and 1 house. And we got EVPs out of this one house. And so that was kind of cool.
Wow. That's amazing. You just, I tell you, you're like a walking history book. And I'm flipping through the pages to see what to say next, but I'm not looking at anything. I'm just, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's just so much to know about Paul Del Roberts. I just want to say that everyone is listening to www.bbsradio.com, Station 1. We are Bridging Wisdom with Paul Del Roberts. He has so many hobbies and recreational activities. Let's get into some of that. Let's talk about your international traveling, and you've been to 50 countries, 50 territories. I mean, flying helicopter, and you know, we had a Cessna 210. Daddy made us learn. We had a Piper first, then we got a Cessna 210, and I know that you got your you flew Cessnas, but Daddy would take it straight up in the air, let it conk out, and we'd have to pull it in case he had a heart attack to know how to handle that.
You know, I could thank my ex-wife again for that because she's the one, every time on my birthday, she'd do some kind of major surprise. And that's one of the good aspects about my ex-wife. And on my birthday, she got me lessons to fly a Cessna. She got me lessons to fly a helicopter.
And that's something.
She got me lessons to jump out of an airplane. And when I jumped out of the airplane one time, I never desired to do it again. And what was so funny is because in the Army, I was supposed to go into the 101st Airborne, but I didn't. And when I became a civilian again, I started tossing and turning in bed because I wanted to know what it would have been like to jump out of an airplane. So she took me to Skydance over in Davis. I took some lessons, jumped out of an airplane one time, and I said, never again. I said, that was it. And I never had those dreams anymore or thought about
it. That is amazing. I kept saying the whole time I hear you talk, you remind me of John DeBoer. He's a flutist. But guess what? He's a Native American flutist. He's married to a real Native American. But the name of their company is Skydance. I kept saying, you tell your stories just like him. And the name of their company is Skydance, and here you went to Skydance. Then that's the parallel lines here in so many areas with everyone's walk of life. You know, you also rode in a hot air balloon and went across the caverns, and you've done so many things, parasailing to rappelling, and
wanted
to touch base on some of your hobbies and activities that you have there.
What it comes down to, Kathy, is I've just really embraced life. I mean, I really, really, really embrace it. I just love it.
You do.
And there's just, and I feel that the whole universe, our world and everything is just a really fascinating place. And one of the things that really, really fascinate me right now is Zakaria Sitchin. He wrote books about the Sumerian clay tablets and the ancient alien theory is just so fascinating. And What's so incredible about it is the fact that everything that you read in the Bible, and if you really believe in the Bible as being true, then you should also too believe in the Sumerian clay tablets, because that was written before the Bible. And what says in the Sumerian clay tablets, you have stories in there that coincide with the Bible. They talk about the flood, they talk about the Garden of Eden and everything else. And what they're telling you is that two half-brothers by the name of Enlil and Enki. Enlil was the politician and leader, and Enki was the scientist and leader. And they're two half-brothers, and they brought with them the Anunnaki. And they came from the planet Nibiru. And they came down here to mine gold. And to mine this gold, the Anunnaki were complaining. They said, hey, you know, why are we out here mining this gold for our dying planet? And the reason why they needed to mine that gold is to correct the ozone layer. So Enlil looks at Enki, his scientist leader brother, and says, hey, why don't you go over there and manipulate the DNA of Cro-Magnon man? And the words that I'm using are not the exact words in the Sumerian clay tablets, but that's what it translates to. So I'm just trying to make it trying to make it easier for you to understand what's in the Sumerian clay tablets. So Enki's over there manipulating the DNA of Cro-Magnon man, and they make Homo sapiens. And so as a as a testing ground, they have the Garden of Eden, and they have a character named Adamu, which is very similar to Adam. And at Adamu's wife, Enki convinces to eat from the tree of knowledge, so she would have universal information. Well, this same story is in your Bible, in the Garden of Eden. It tells you it's the same story, but it's in the Sumerian clay tablets. And then Enlil finds out that Adamu's wife eats from the tree of knowledge, and he banishes them out of the Garden of Eden, which is basically a testing ground. And as you continue to read it, and let me tell you, Kathy, when I went to the British Royal Museum, I saw this. I saw three Sumerian clay tablets, and when I looked at it, I said, "What the heck is this?" You know, and this is from one of our first civilizations that had writing. And when I started reading what was on those tablets, I was just totally blown away. I said, what the heck, you know? They're saying they're from another planet. So as I'm reading this, Enlil gets kind of upset with the Homo sapiens because they're rebellious, they're multiplying too fast. And at some point in time, he says, I'm going to wipe them out with a flood. Well, Enki...
That's a Noah. Noah
and the Ark. Yeah, there we go. And Enki loves his creation, so he convinces this one family to build an ark. And on this ark, instead of the story where you hear about the two animals going on the ark, you know, how would you fit all those animals on the ark? But if you look at the Sumerian clay tablets and you understand the translation, you would understand that they took the DNA of each animal and placed it like in a test tube on the ark.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And they had this family on the ark taking care of those test tubes with the DNA of every animal on Earth.
Well, you know, there you have it with the altering of the DNA.
Yeah. There you go. And also, here's the mind blower. Okay.
They transplanted thoughts in our brain.
No,
I'm just kidding. It's a parallel world there.
Yeah, and scientists recently found out that if you throw gold dust into the ozone layer, it will correct it. So how did the Sumerians know that unless they were told?
Wow. That's amazing.
That is amazing.
You know, to me, I learned about the hole in the ozone layer coming, you know, in school. And it was because we're cutting down all the trees and everything, and we breathe the trees, and the trees breathe us. And what do you, before we get off the air, because you are scheduled to come back next week, let's just say, what do you feel could correct all of the situation that we have going on today? With all that do you think it's UFOs? Do you feel that they're going to come and... I don't feel they're coming to help us, because if they do, then they've got to help us the rest of our life, and we'll be will be dependent upon them, you know. But I believe there's good and bad aliens, and I believe we're in a Star Wars out there.
Yeah. Well, when Shannon McCabe and I, Shannon McCabe's my partner. She's the owner of HPI, and of course, I'm the general manager. When we did the Penn and Teller BS show, and we flew down to Mexico for the Mayan Prophecy of 2012, and they selected me because I wrote the article about 2012. But on December 21st, 2012, when the Earth actually aligns with the center of the galaxy, well, the Mayans got that right. That's going to happen. Okay. And they said that in the center of the galaxy is a womb, a W-O-M-B. And in the center of the galaxy, scientists recently discovered that there is like a black hole there. So again, how did the Mayans know that? I do believe, you know, because they do believe that their god, the Mayan god, will come back. And so I believe at some point in time that we will find out that we have galactic brothers out there. And when we get too crazy and we're out there maybe, you know, really destroying our world, that's the time that our galactic brothers will come in and say, okay, enough is enough, you know. So I do believe that some type of change like that will probably occur in the future.
Do you feel that they're going to come down to Earth and say, get on the ship?
I don't know about that, but
well, that's just that, you know, that's just one of those stories out there. Yeah. I was just wondering if you'd heard it, but
no. But I believe they have bases out here. I mean, Lake Titicaca is a prime example of a possible UFO base in the water. Monterey Bay, I investigated that. There's UFOs when they're in the water, they're USOs. Unidentified submerged objects. When they come out of the water, they become UFOs. And people in Monterey Bay constantly see UFOs coming out of the ocean from Monterey Bay.
And
I believe there's a UFO base there. I believe they're already here.
Kind of like that Atlantis.
Yeah, they're basically just observing us.
Right. I was told in a vision, I go up to get, believe it or not, that's just what I do in my meditations, but I call them Mother and Father, and she's always got on a Statue of Liberty, because she didn't want to scare me. But they're here to learn about feelings. That's one of the things that they don't have very much of, is they understand it, but they can't really feel it. They are more logical, you know.
Yeah, I've actually heard that. That's why they're very concerned about human mind.
Oh, you've heard that. That's amazing. Yeah. That's great to know. Because that's my visions. And they also... because of our feelings, that's what's got us in this turmoil. And so that's why they're not in a turmoil. That's what they've told me in my dreams. You know, and that our feelings are worn on our shoulders, that we have these ego, you know, and we're all defensive because we don't like to be told no. They're trying to understand where this comes from. And that's what they tell me in my sleep. So I don't know. But you're right on with letting me know about that. I appreciate that you've heard that before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, well, you know, touch is a very powerful thing because you're actually trading energy with another person. So when you hug somebody and everything else, that's a very healthy thing because you're receiving a lot of positive energy from that person. And also, in turn, you're giving that person positive energy.
Right. I go up there in meditations to align myself, you know, to get out of, it's like a trance thing I do, to go really high. Up in just away from everything with the world. And it's been something I've done since I was a little girl that I can even remember. I don't remember not doing it and study, you know, looking at the stars and stuff and saying, that's where I came from. But I know that I'm a Christian and, you know, I believe I'm going to heaven. But I know that there's, you know, different places out there. But Paul, we've got to wrap it up. I would love for you to just tell how to get in touch with you and how they can search you out. Give your web pages and websites and the new book that you just wrote.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. I love being on your show. I'm probably about the easiest person to find right now. I mean, all they have to do basically is just Google my name, Paul Dale Roberts. But my website is www.hpipath.com. paranormal.net. And you can see a lot of my stories right on my website, too. Another website is www.jasmaonline.com. And in all of my articles, I always have my cell phone number because I get contacts from all over the world about various investigations and stuff like that. And if I can't make the investigation, I find a team in that area to do the investigation for them. So, So anyway, I'm all over the place, so I'm pretty easy to find.
I read some of your work. Let's touch the Michael Jackson thing really quick because so many people love Michael Jackson.
Oh, well, we were called out, Shannon McCabe and myself, we were called out to Los Angeles, and we did a show called Michael Jackson in Search of His Spirit for Sky One TV in London. Mm-hmm. And we got over there, and this guy brought the hair and scalp of Michael Jackson because a stagehand found it at the Shrine Auditorium where they filmed the 1984 commercial, the Pepsi commercial, in which his hair caught on fire. And he paid for it I can't even think of it now. The internet where you buy things from
eBay.
eBay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he bought it on eBay for about $500,000, and he brought it in an envelope. He's going to eventually take the hair and scalp and make it into a diamond. But Bobby Marchesso, a channeler, tried to channel Michael Jackson because of the hair and the scalp. And at the time, I was trying to get an EVP, and I got an EVP, electronic voice phenomenon, of a little boy saying, Michael. So that was kind of interesting, but do I really think it was Michael? I don't know. I think maybe it was a ghost who was mimicking Michael Jackson.
And knew why you were there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I got my
Michael
dog.
Michael Jackson is amazing. I just want to say, with that video that you have, that's one of the ones I looked at. And then the other one was when you were going, I think it was to Mexico, but you had Shannon was looking out the window telling about where y'all were going to go, and y'all were right across from the haunted place, and a peacock. She goes, oh, hello. And that's the story about my mother. She had three feathers fall on her shoulders, and she wanted proof that Daddy was there. And there comes that Peppy the peacock. That's how that coincided, that I wanted to just tell the active listening audience that, you know, for that peacock to show up out of nowhere, outside your hotel, that five-star hotel, that's just an amazing thing because peacocks are mean so many different things. They mean rising from ashes to the falcon rising to, you know, rejuvenation. And it's just amazing. Paul, I have had a wonderful time. It's like we're just sitting back in the living room talking. And
oh,
you're just
I love it.
I know. I'm going to take you up on that offer, come out to see you.
Oh, that'd be great, Kathy. I would absolutely love that.
Yeah. But with that, we will see you next week. Everybody look up Paul Del Roberts and read about him, get to know him. And you are on Facebook, right? That's how I found you because you were a friend of my fiance, Michael's. And that's how I got to know you. Mystery man. The mystery man.
My dog is over here acting up, so he's like looking at me going, when do I get my walk?
Yeah, Puppy's over at the door too. She's doing the same thing, Puppy Whoopi. So anyway, with that, I'm going to thank you so much. And it's a privilege and a new friendship that's evolved. And I just want to tell Shannon thank you for all that she does. And Paul, we'll see you out there. We'll see you next week. This is Kathy Cook. Bright Lights Pathfinders, we are bridging wisdom, one wisdom spoke at a time, bringing life higher one octave at a time. And with that, we're off the air. Bye-bye.